This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Center for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Francis Day, I remember the Ask an Astronomer section where it was said that black holes could not account for dark matter. Also, I gather that medium-sized black holes were thought not to exist. Now here is NASA saying the opposite. It would be great if the Jodcast could tell us more.
Well, I certainly hope we can oblige. We generally see two kinds of black holes in the universe today. Most black holes are created when very massive stars undergo supernovae, and these end up a few times the mass of the Sun. The other kind, supermassive black holes, are found in the center of galaxies and are a few million times the mass of the Sun. How these supermassive black holes form and grow has been a matter of some debate over the last few decades. In stellar systems, which can be anything from small clusters to big galaxies, there's a process called mass segregation which occurs. And when a star forms in a cluster, or near the center of the galaxy, it's got some motion compared to the stars around it. And as each star moves, it comes closer to the other stars in the cluster or galaxy, and they gravitationally interact with each other. This can form binary stars, but more usually the two stars kind of dance past each other, exchanging energy and moving off in different directions and different speeds to which they started with. On average, the smaller star gets more energy from the bigger star, so it can be kicked out of the cluster, while the bigger star loses energy and sinks towards the middle of the cluster. So the middle of a cluster or galaxy contains the biggest stars in the end, and that can include black holes. And because black holes are heavier than the average star, they tend to sink towards the middle of clusters and galaxies. Over timescales of millions or billions of years, they're thought to congregate in the middle of galaxies. And earlier this month, there was evidence published that there's maybe tens of thousands of stellar mass black holes in the middle of our galaxy as a result of this mass segregation process. Once black holes congregate in the middle of a galaxy, they can start interacting with each other. Some of these interactions will form new binary systems, made of either a star plus a black hole, or made of a pair of black holes. Even once a black hole is in a binary system like this, gravitational interactions with other stars keep happening. These tend to force the two components of the binary system closer together, a process called hardening. And in binary hardening, a pair of objects comes closer and closer together. If the binary is made of a star and a black hole, the star will be gradually sucked into the black hole, forming an X-ray binary system. But if both objects in the binary are black holes, gravitational radiation will take over, and the two black holes will coalesce into one bigger black hole. Now, we don't know if supermassive black holes can be formed in this way, but it's thought that intermediate mass black holes might. Now, these intermediate mass black holes are maybe a few thousand times the mass of the Sun, and until recently we didn't have any good evidence they existed. Many astronomers have claimed in the past to find evidence for intermediate mass black holes, but it's been hard to prove that these are actually black holes. Since black holes are black, we have to look for their influence on other stars. And one good place to look for intermediate mass black holes is in the center of globular clusters, where there are lots of stars very close together. These should betray the presence of any nearby black holes. Globular clusters are bigger than the Oerken clusters we see forming in our galaxy today, but smaller than the galaxy in their own right. We think these form in very violent events when galaxies crash into each other, and we see these globular clusters undergoing the processes of mass segregation and hardening of binaries, so they should be able to form and retain black holes in the centers themselves. Some of the best evidence for intermediate mass black holes actually comes from a recent paper published by a pulsar group at Jodrell Bank. This found good evidence for a black hole of at least 20,000 times the mass of our Sun in the globular cluster NGC 6624. So we think that there are intermediate mass black holes out there, but they're hard to find, and we don't yet know how many of them there are and what role they play in putting together the supermassive black holes in the middle of galaxies.
Stanley Fertig, Mars lost its original CO2-rich atmosphere due to sputtering caused by the solar wind, against which Mars's lack of the magnetic field provided little or no protection. Venus as well lacks a strong magnetic field, yet has kept its atmosphere. Why Mars and not Venus?
The density and the composition of a planet's atmosphere is quite a delicate and complex balance between a few different things. This includes how it interacts with the Sun and what the planet's surface is below it. The most important factor is the radiation that the planet receives from its star. This dictates the chemistry that goes on in its atmosphere, which chemicals be gases or clouds, and which will be liquids or solids on the surface. Since Venus is a lot closer to the Sun than Mars, its surface is hotter. But as we'll see, this isn't the end of the story. There's two main ways that the Sun can evaporate a planet's atmosphere, either because charged particles from the solar wind sandblast the atmosphere off into space, or because the atmosphere gets so hot that it literally starts boiling off the planet. Boiling off material from a planet is simple. If the gas in the atmosphere is going faster than gravity can hold it, it'll escape. The critical point is reached when the bulk of the gas is going at about a sixth of the escape velocity, and then some of the atoms will go fast enough to escape the planet's gravity. We call this Jeans escape. And the lighter the molecule, the faster it'll go. None of the terrestrial planets was big enough or cool enough to retain its original atmosphere of hydrogen or helium, but most other molecules tend to be stable enough to stay in the atmosphere. After hydrogen and helium, carbon and oxygen are the next most abundant elements that formed our solar system, so carbon dioxide became a major part of the atmospheres of all the early terrestrial planets, including the Earth. And if you heat up a gas, its molecules will travel faster, so hot planets lose their atmospheres faster. But the temperature of a planet's atmosphere isn't always the same as its surface, and Venus's atmosphere is full of very white clouds. These keep the surface hot, but they also reflect a lot of the Sun's light, which means that the top of Venus's atmosphere is surprisingly cool. The top of the atmospheres of Venus and Mars actually have very similar temperatures. But Mars has a lower gravity, and this makes boiling off the atmosphere from Mars easier than it is from Venus. So while Mars's atmosphere is evaporating, it's probably not the main reason for the difference in the planet's atmospheric density. Even if a molecule is too heavy to undergo Jeans escape, it can be still stripped off the planet by the solar wind. On Earth, we're protected from this because the solar plasma interacts with our magnetic field, and that diverts the solar wind around the planet. Venus and Mars don't have strong magnetic fields to protect them. Venus rotates too slowly, and the core of Mars is solidified. However, Venus's atmosphere does protect itself. Plasma generated by the solar wind forms an ionosphere around the planet, and this buffers the planet against further damage by the solar wind, a bit like a bow shock forms around a supersonic aeroplane. Mars's atmosphere doesn't have the density to do this effectively, so the atmosphere of Mars is more readily lost to sputtering by the solar wind. However, perhaps the most important factor is how the planet's crust and atmosphere interact. On Earth, we've got photosynthetic life, weathering of rocks, sequestration of carbon into the oceans, and plate tectonics, and these all play a role in removing carbon dioxide from our atmosphere. In about a billion years, the Sun will get bright enough to evaporate the oceans, and this will kill life and stop plate tectonics. And at this point, we'll end up with an atmosphere that is much more like Venus's than Earth's atmosphere is today. Venus already lacks these influences, which is why its water and CO2 are almost entirely in its atmosphere. Because Mars's surface is colder, most of its water and CO2 are locked up in its ice caps and underground. If these were released all into the atmosphere at the same time, Mars's atmosphere would actually end up about as dense as Earth's is today. So while the atmosphere of both planets is beginning to gradually be eroded by the solar wind, the difference between the atmospheres of Venus and Mars is probably more down to the lower temperature of Mars condensing its atmosphere out into its surface.
And Stone, the universe has been in existence for billions of years. In that time, stars have converted huge amounts of matter to energy. Photons exert a pressure and have a theoretical mass. Couldn't this account for dark matter and dark energy?
Well, we have no idea what dark matter and dark energy actually are, but we can rule out things they aren't. And photons happen to be one of the things we can rule out, if only because it's rather perverse to talk about dark things being made of light. It's quite a complicated problem to work out exactly how much light there is in the universe, but this is actually one of those questions you can solve on the back of an envelope using a little bit of dimensional analysis, that is, making crude estimates with very approximate numbers. Let's first look at the universe's budget, mass, and energy. Photons don't actually have a mass, but they do have a rest mass. Mass-energy equivalence, E equals mc squared, tells us they can still contribute to the rest mass-energy of the universe. Results from the Planck satellite suggest that dark energy accounts for roughly 68% of the universe's rest mass-energy, while 26% is in dark matter. Now, we know these numbers are accurate to within about a percent or two, because otherwise they would influence the curvature of the universe, the universe's expansion history, and the abundance of the elements that were forged in the Big Bang. And this means that baryons, what we call normal matter, only account for about 5% of the universe, actually slightly less. So surprisingly, most of this 5% is also missing. Using a technique known as the Snyder-Zeldovich effect, we know that most of this baryonic mass is in the very diffuse gas that exists between stars and galaxies. It doesn't emit much light, especially at optical wavelengths, but it makes up the majority of the normal matter in the universe. In fact, it's estimated that only about 0.2% of the universe is actually in the stars themselves. So what we think of as conventional astronomy really involves little more than 0.2% of the universe. If light is to explain dark matter, it must be more concentrated close to galaxies, since this is where we see the effects of dark matter to be. Normal stars are responsible for most of the light emitted by galaxies. The Sun loses about 4 million tons worth of light every second. It converts 4 million tons of matter into energy. And that's 7 times more than it loses via the solar wind. But overall, this is still a very, very tiny fraction of its mass. The Sun will get a lot brighter as it gets older, so this mass lost via light will increase. And most of its light that it will emit over its entire lifetime is actually in 2 short periods just before the Sun dies. Yet the Sun will still only convert about 3/1000ths of its current mass into light. Stars live for a very different length of time, and each one converts a very different fraction of its mass back into light. However, we can roughly approximate that the Sun is a typical star, and that we can typically account for 3 different generations of stars throughout the lifetime of the universe so far. That means that we can multiply that 3/1000ths by 3, and let's round up a bit to be generous, to say that there's about 100 times more mass currently in stars than has ever been converted into light. So let's divide that 0.2% of matter in stars by 100. And we find that about 2/1000ths of the universe's rest mass energy budget is actually made of photons. So that makes it a totally insignificant component of the universe's rest mass energy, and certainly not enough to account for the majority of the universe. Of course, this is a very approximate and hand-wavy argument, but it shows how physicists can quickly obtain a rough guess of the answer using just a few facts. In reality, the dominant source of radiation in the universe is still the cosmic microwave background, and while this may seem a feeble light to us, it only heats up the universe to about 2.7 degrees above absolute zero, it's evenly spread among the universe almost exactly, and so it adds up to quite a lot. In fact, the cosmic microwave background alone can account for about 1/10,000th of the entire universe. So rather curiously then, we live in a universe where this feeble heat not only contains almost all the light in the universe, but that effectively weighs about 5% as much as the stars themselves. So there really is a whole universe out there waiting to be discovered.